Hi, Saeed.
Hey, Mel, how are you doing?
Oh my God, amazing.
That's what I'm talking about. Another episode of
Two Writers
Talking Shit.
Now, our guest today is such a get. It feels like Christmas has come early. And perhaps Christmas does come early this year. We can't say for sure. Now, our guest today, he is the creator, executive producer, and showrunner of No Good Nick. He has a more prolific body of work than almost any writer working in Hollywood. I mean, just a few TV and film credits include Slackers, American Pie 2, National Lampoon's Barely Legal, Puss in Boots, The Simpsons, Space Racers, and many more. Please welcome to the podcast, David Steinberg.
Thank you. Wow, that was a great intro. Awesome. I have done a few things. Please call me Dave. People call me Dave. I have to use David H because when I joined the guild, there's like 20 other David Steinberg, so I'm David H, but no one called me. Just call me Dave.
Dave, look, side note, I have a story about Dave. Now, you, in 2020, when I was a lonely writer working a shitty job during COVID,
yep.
You read my Atlanta spec.
Yep.
And this is before I was in Nickelodeon. This is before I got staffed on Showtime. And this is before I got an overall deal. But you were one of the first people to say, and I have it here because I saved it. You were like, love the dialogue, spot on voices, funny throughout, but also heartfelt. And what's crazy about this time is you said this in December. Yes, I stalked a tweet. And at that time, I had got rejected from Warner Brothers Fellowship and I felt like shit. And you had read, you created an opportunity where you were accepting scripts to read, which is super kind. And I sent you my spec and you read it. And that kept me energized going through the winter to the next year. So I want to say thank you, man.
Well, I really appreciate you saying that. I mean, you're welcome, first of all. But secondly, like, I love it when people like tell me, because I do stuff from time to time. And it's like kind of, I mean, it's a little bit of a hassle for me, but it's, and relatively speaking, it's not that big a deal. And you don't realize the impact you can have on people's lives. You go, oh, yeah, I read your script. I wrote one tweet. I was like, yeah, this is really good. Great job, man. And like, you don't realize what that leads to. And like, it actually, you know, helps your career. And like, I feel like now I've discovered, you know, a diamond in the rough. It helps, by the way, it helps my credibility. Because if I tweet out, say, I read the script, it's really good, and the person goes on to become successful, I'm like, well, I have good taste. It makes me feel like I know what I'm doing. And so I love to hear that story. That's really, I appreciate you telling me.
Yeah, well, like, it's crazy because how many scripts did you get? Like, I can only imagine.
So here's a little history of that whole thing. So in 2019 is when the whole thing started. So if you remember, Liz Alper and some other, and Javi, some other people came up with this. It wasn't my idea. When everyone had to fire their agents, the agents were like, well, how are you going to do staffing? If you don't have agents, no one, the business is going to shut down. And these other writers came up with the idea, well, we're just going to read the scripts ourselves. We'll have upper level writers, showrunners, whatnot, will read scripts. The ones they like, we'll make a database. And then when you're staffing a show, you just go to the database. We don't even need the agents. So they came up with this Solidarity Challenge 2019. And I thought that was such a great idea. I met with the two of them and I had some ideas on how to make it more streamlined. I came up with like the idea of doing the boilerplate, like, what do you call it? Disclaimer or whatever.
Yeah.
The thing that you have to sign to make it easier. So that, and also the problem when they first started it was if you said you were going to read some script, they knew you were going to read it. And then if you didn't like it, they knew you didn't like it.
Yeah.
I came up with a system where like, you didn't know you were getting read until someone said they liked it. So you could pretend that if no one said anything, no one read it.
Yeah.
Not that everyone hated it. So that was a big thing. Anyway, so I helped them and the three of us kind of we rolled with this thing and we really read a lot of scripts that summer. So what I did is I thought it was so rewarding hearing from writers and just like trying to pay it forward. I never really had a mentor. I'm like, I've got some free time, not a lot, but some. And I'm like, I'm willing to like help out. And there's so many people out there like, I'm not going to fucking read your script, man. Well, I'm like, you know what? I will read your script. Not all the time, but some of the time. So I kind of morphed it into like a birthday thing where like on my birthday, which I don't know if this is coming up before or after my birthday, but it's August 24th. I've been doing this thing where like, I'm like, you know what? I'm going to read some scripts on my birthday. I don't read all year round. But then I opened it up and said, hey, here's the thing. You want to send me your script? I'm not guaranteeing I'm going to read it, but I'll read some of them. I got 400 the first year. That was probably 2020.
Yeah.
And then the next 2 years, I was like 600, 700. I get a lot of scripts, you know, and I was also only reading half hour pilots because you know, a feature script's too much to ask. You know, if you're 100 pages up, that's too much. And I'm not an expert. I've written 1 hour, and actually we sold a 1 hour, my wife and I, but we're not experts on 1 hour. So also they're longer. So I just kind of said half hour pilots. And so I kind of like kicked all the 1 hour people to the curb and just said half hour people. But I'm still reading probably 70 to 100 of them in that like 1 to 2 weeks after my birthday. And, you know, and then maybe I'll like half of them and like shout out a couple, you know, maybe 30 of them. And I don't tell everyone, oh, I read your script and didn't like it. So there's a lot of reading involved. But, and I always say to myself, when my birthday's coming up like it is now, I'm like, am I going to do this again? It's a huge hassle. It's like, man, I'm going to read all these scripts. And I'm like, yeah, but you know, it's like picketing and stuff. You know, you don't want to do it, but you feel like it's good for you. It's bigger deal for them. And it's like, you feel good afterwards. It's like the feeling of like, it's like Christmas, you said, you know, you're the feeling of giving something, paying back makes you feel good, even though it's like, yes, it's a hassle to do it. So I keep doing it. I'm going to do it again. You know, I read as many as I can. And like, look, no one's ever said, hey, you should have read more, because I do as much as I can. And you also find some really great scripts in there. And you know, if you read ones that are like, okay, this person, I'm not saying they're a bad writer, but they're maybe too inexperienced. You know, they haven't written enough pilots. They don't know what they're doing. And you read a few pages, go, okay, well, this person's not ready yet. And you just pass, you just move on. You go to the next one. So it's not that hard.
Yeah. It also, like you doing that, it's a trickle down, because now I do that. Like, you know what I'm saying? Oh, so maybe. Now it makes me want to read more scripts from like upcoming writers. So I do think it's like a cycle. So we appreciate that.
Yeah.
You know,
and not to pat myself on the back or anything, but I do make it be like, if you are any kind of like underrepresented group, you're going to the front of the line. And I prefer to read, you know, it's like the people who don't have any problems getting read in Hollywood don't need my help.
Yeah. Facts.
Shout out to David. Shout out to David's Twitter, which is the only Twitter where I'm subscribed to. I have like notifications when like David tweets, even for my good mate here, Balance 510. I don't put the notifications on. In fact, I mute him. I'm like, tell me when he's not on. You know, that's when I'll get back on here.
Well, now I need to like make sure my tweets are all like really 5-star. Like if I'm just like, hey, I had a ham sandwich for lunch. No, I don't do that. But you're like, oh, no, like Mel's going to get a notification about this.
No, I mean,
No pressure.
The only notification I'm going to get, 5-star diamond, every tweet. Okay. You wrote this incredible thread detailing your epic spec sale of Slackers. And it really feels like, I mean, listen, I don't think specs sell that way anymore. I mean, I wish that they did. It would give me like some kind of, you know, a crazy fantasy wish. But I don't think they do. So it sort of really feels like this time capsule of like a Hollywood of like yesteryear that like we don't really live in anymore. So can you just, I mean, I know that you detail the whole story on Twitter and everybody needs to go read that thread because it's an education. But can you sort of tell us how that came into fruition? Like, I mean, how did you get your agent who even took that spec out?
Yeah. I mean, that story is like the like a Hollywood late 90s. It's hard to believe that it really was that way. But like when I was in film school and we would get Daily Variety at USC, we were in the producing program, my wife and I, and we had 25 classmates, and we weren't married at the time. That's how we met. But they give you Daily Variety as part of your tuition. If you're for second year, first year you get Hollywood Reporter, then second year you get Daily Variety. And every day you'd be opening up on the front page, you'd be like, this script sold for this much money. Page two, this script, it was like 3 or 4 sales, you know, maybe like 10 a week. Because it was the era of like spec sales. People were just buying left and right. So it was an exciting time. And everyone wanted to be a film writer because of that. You thought you could like, it's like the gold rush. You go to California, you write your script, sell for $1 million. And it was like, people did it.
Yeah, literally $1 million.
Yeah. Oh, all the time. I mean, I didn't, I got close, but yeah, it was not that uncommon to sell a script for $1 million. You know, once or twice a week, definitely someone would do that. So I had been a lawyer and I didn't like my job and I moved across. I applied to film school, got in. There's a whole story about, you know, how I spent the next 6 months secretly knowing I was going to film school, but I stopped working and in my mind, but I showed up and I was kind of doing a whole thing where I was wondering whether I was going to get fired or not. So there was about 6 months where I was playing a little game with my law firm as to, will they fire me or won't they? But eventually they did not fire me and I gave them my 2 weeks notice. I drove across country with my dad. I've got a story about that too, but I can't tell it because it's a PG podcast. And it has to do with my dad thinking that I had got a kink in my neck and that I needed a massage. Anyways, I'm
gonna tell you a massage story. Boy.
But we got to LA.
That's behind the paywall, people. That's a behind the paywall story.
So that summer, I was going to the producing program. So the Peter Stark programs for graduate MFA producing. I didn't know what that was. I was going to the program, but I thought everyone would have a script. So that summer, I wrote a script. I wrote a Chris Farley comedy. This is in the summer of 97. He's still alive at the time. And I got to LA. I had written a Star Trek Voyager spec first. That was my first script. And this was my first like original, not TV sample. Mm-hmm. So I had my one spec script. And when I got to LA, I didn't know anyone. And I was doing what you did back then. You sent out queries. Of course, then you could email them. And we had email. But you were like sending out queries and saying like, would you be interested in representing me? Blah, blah, blah. And I can send you this script. And I didn't really get any traction on it. So then when I started the program, I met my classmates and I had that one script and everyone else wanted to produce and they didn't have a script. I didn't really realize that producers didn't write scripts. So they started passing. They're like, oh, you write a comedy? Chris Farley? Sure. He's a huge star. I'll tell you the log line. It's going to sound idiotic now, but in 1997, this was a good idea.
Please, please.
So it was called Weight of the World. It was about an overweight man, Chris Farley, who wakes up in an alternate universe where overweight people are sexy and thin people are not sexy.
Love it.
According to society standards. So the trailer moment is him walking down the street wearing spandex to the beach, staying alive. There's also, it's like just set piece, set piece, set piece. And there's a set piece of him like in a bar doing karaoke, singing, Do You Think I'm Sexy by Rod Stewart. So it's just like every obvious joke you can imagine. It's like, that's what the screenplay is full of.
Yeah.
And he's heavy and everyone wants to have sex with him. The end. Liar Liar had just come out and it was like, it was like, okay, you have a very simple high concept idea and you just milk it to death.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, who wants to read my script? And everyone in class is like, oh, I'll produce that. I want to produce it. Oh, let me read it. And so everyone wanted to read my script. And the one person in class who had some connections was my now wife and writing partner and co-showrunner, Keechi Kogan. And she had come from she'd been a UCLA undergrad and she had gone to the UCLA summer film program where she met a lawyer. And so she's read the script. Oh, we could totally sell. I don't think people said this was great. I think they said we could sell this. You know, there was like a big difference. It was like, oh, this is a slam dunk sale. No one was said like, oh my God, this is the best thing I ever read. They were just like, we can definitely sell this. So, you know, and they probably would have, they would be like, okay, yeah, I can make that movie. And so she got it to the lawyer. The lawyer read it. He got it to an agent. I was like in LA for like a couple weeks and like Paradigm was like, okay, we'll represent you.
Oh my God.
I was represented Paradigm just because they passed it from person to person. And the lesson of that story is that it's a referral is 100 times better than a query. Now you can get success in queries. You can send out emails to cold things and just say, like, then it's going to largely rely on the high conceptness, if it's a TV pilot or a film spec, saying like, I have a really big idea for a TV show. If you have Severance, you know, that's not the typical TV show. Most shows are very execution driven, they're character driven. But if you have an idea that's like a really cool idea, like Severance, that's a kind of script that you probably, if you'd written it on spec, could have gotten people to be like, oh, that sounds cool. Let me read that. And you know, people say, well, should I mention my contest? Should I mention this? Should I mention that? It's like your background's relevant, but largely it's like, do I want to read the script or not? Kind of just boils down to that. So I'm like, oh, wow, you know, are a Rhodes Scholar. That sounds great, but not that interested in ideas, so I don't really care. So saying I was a quarterfinalist in this contest is like, okay, do I want to read this or not? So the query thing is really, really hard. What cuts through the red tape is someone saying, I know this guy. I read this script. I liked it. anyone. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter if it's like, you know, Steven Spielberg read your script and thought it was great. It matters that someone did. And that where that is coming full circle now. So that's what's so helpful about the shout out. So when I read people's scripts and I say on Twitter, you know, whatever it was, 180 characters, I read this script. You don't know who I am, but I'm somebody that you can check my credits on. And I thought it was good. And it doesn't matter what the details are. It's saying, I read it and I thought it was good. The end. That's your referral. Now you could say, hey, David Steinberg, whether you know him or not, is a legitimate person who read my script and said it was good. And he's willing to verify that he read it and thought it was good. People say, okay, I'll read it. Mm-hmm. And it's as simple as that. If people put in their query letter, so-and-so read the script and thought it was good, people say, okay, I'll take a shot. Because it's all about, you know, people don't want to take risks. People are afraid of saying that they like something. You know, creative executives are constantly saying no to things because their jobs are at stake if they go out on a limb and say this looks great and it bombs. So someone going out on that limb is a huge psychological has the psychological effect of breaking down that red flag barrier and saying, okay, well, someone said it was good. Mm-hmm. So my shields are down. I'll take a look. So that's why a referral is so important. But then what the definition of a referral is very vague. And like nowadays, whether it's a tweet or something, whether it's they know someone or don't know the person, just having someone to be able to like vouch for something, because it's a relationship business, and being able to vouch for people and vouch for scripts is the key to getting that, you know, that in the door, essentially. Yeah. That's how I got an agent. Then as far as the story, you can read the story on Twitter where I talk about the script going out, and it's a whole long thing, but that's how I get an agent. It actually wasn't the Paradigm agent, because it was the assistant at Paradigm who left and became an agent in APA and took me with him. I had written a script that didn't sell. Chris Farley died, so that became a sample. And then I wrote another script that didn't sell. That assistant at Paradigm went to APA, became my new agent. I went to APA, and he said, write something R-rated. American Pie's coming out this summer. No one knew what that was, but he had seen like an early cut of it or something. I wrote an R-rated thing, came out a month after American Pie. And the story of selling it and sending that script out, like physically sending it with messengers, and like people are faxing shit. It's a lot of like technology involved, but it's a crazy story. And at the end of the day, that script did sell for a huge amount of money, not a million, but almost. And, you know, launched my career. I broke into the Writers Guild, got American Pie 2 a month later because of the Slacker sale. And I had 3 movies in production in 18 months because of that spec sale.
Goodness gracious. It's interesting though, because no matter the technology and the time, it's still the same, which is the getting the recommendation, getting the cosign, you know, and that's part of then the relationship, which is still, no matter what, most important. Yeah. I have a question. Oh, go ahead. No.
Yeah, I think that it's like being then and now, as Saeed is saying, it's like being vetted is your ticket to your career. That's all I was going to say.
So I got a question. So like a lot of the, you know, the writers that listen to our podcast or upcoming writers who are like placing in contests and like, you know, writing. And one of the things they always wonder is like, our goal is to be a staff writer, right? And the question I have for you is, what do you expect in your room as a showrunner from a first time staff writer? Like, what are a few things that you expect from them?
Well, it's weird that like these days you have to write like an original pilot to sort of break in, because that's not what I expect. I don't really care about your ability to create characters, and like your voice is, it's wonderful that you have an original voice. I don't really need to know it, because I want you to write in my voice. So like, it's almost like a set of skills that are irrelevant to the job, which is that you have to be a problem solver, you know, have a great attitude, and, you know, you could point out problems, love it, but also tell me the solutions. You know, it's like, oh, this doesn't actually make sense. What if we did this instead? That's good. And I think the most important skill in a staff writer is just resilience. You need to be like, I don't know if this is a dated reference, Energizer Bunny is what we used to say. It's like, you pitch ideas, especially in a comedy room. It's easy to pitch a joke that doesn't land and then get embarrassed and shut down. I experienced that many times myself. You go, oh man, what if he said this? And everyone's like, okay. And you're like, oh geez, you're just bombed. I mean, I'm not a stand-up comic, but you can imagine bombing, the whole room doesn't laugh. You're like, okay, good night, folks, I'm done. But you're a staff writer, you'd be like, okay, well, if that didn't work, what about this? And coming back from a pitch that doesn't land, it doesn't have to be a joke, but also like say, what if we did this story idea? And you might think like it's amazing. And you're like, I have a whole episode in mind. What if they did this, 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 and this? And the showrunner's thinking about 10 other things. It's like, okay, is that a good story? Is it producible? Are we using all our characters? Do we have to build new sets? Do we have the money for that? You know, do we, is that like, oh, well, that would require different equipment that would be expensive or be a time problem? Or there's a whole million things that you're thinking of when you're trying to produce the show that you might not have time to tell the staff writer, oh, I think your idea is great, but the reason I'm saying no is because we actually only have 1.5 days this week to shoot instead of 2, and yours would require a new set that we don't, I mean, you're not going to say that. You're just be like, oh, that's really great. That sounds hilarious. Maybe next season. Anyways, moving on, who's got a different idea?
Yeah.
And they're like, okay, well, that's just, they hated it because they like made some bullshit thing about next season and then just moved on. Because you're just so busy, you don't have time to explain why you're saying no. Mm-hmm. So the helpful thing for a staff writer, you don't have to be extroverted because most writers are not. Most writers are introverted. You have to be willing to speak up, though. If you're too introverted and you're just going to be like, I've got a lot of great ideas, but they're all in my head, that's bad. If you're like, I can write great, but I can't talk great, that's bad. It is a communal experience. So you need to be able to like, get along with the people in the room, you know, have a good read on when is a good time to like volunteer something, when is a good time to listen. So like a staff writer who's like jumping in all the time, everyone might think that person's annoying because they're talking too much. Talking too little, bad. Talking too much, bad. Talking just the right amount, pointing out, you know, problems that they can fix or just fixes if there's other problems. And then just being like, hey, I need someone to like come up with 10 ideas for this or 10 ideas for that and being like, no problem, I'm on it. Mm-hmm. Just the person who's like the volunteer to do the shit work. It's not always shit. I mean, you're in a room. It's like people are dreaming of being in this position. But if I'm like, hey, we need like a better joke for the end of this scene. Can you just, I have to go do this other thing. I'm not even going to be here. But when I get back, can you just have 10 things to pitch me? You know, and like, it might not just be you, it might be the whole rest of the room, it might be a couple people, maybe you break up the room, whatever. I just need you to do something, come up with 10 ideas. And then when I get back, I'll be like, yeah, these are okay. That one. Good. Great. Thank you. Now I've got it. That's the joke we'll use. Or we didn't like all of them, but not, they all didn't work, but thank you for trying. So just like not getting your feelings hurt when your ideas are rejected, because most of them will be rejected, but not necessarily because they were bad.
Yeah.
So that's kind of like energizer, good attitude, reading the room, not getting down on yourself, and just like being there to learn also. Mm-hmm. Because the idea that a staff writer needs to know how to be a staff writer is idiotic, right?
Right.
Because you're there to learn. You don't have to have been an assistant for 10 years. You can be like someone who came just out of college and like you wrote a great script and you got an agent and you got a meeting and you got the job and you don't have any experience. That's fine. No one's like, no, as a staff writer, you need to know how to be a staff writer. I'll explain how to do it. You just have to be able to do it. So knowing how to do the job is totally irrelevant. And knowing how to write a pilot is totally useless because, you know, in the olden days, whatever, 20, 30 years ago, you couldn't get a meeting as a staff writer to pitch a show because why would they take a meeting from a staff writer? You had to be a co-EP or an EP to pitch a show.
Yeah,
because that's the person who knew how to produce the show. They weren't going to, I mean, now it's like, well, you can pair the staff writer with the showrunner, whatever, whatever. But being able to write a pilot is not really a useful skill set. But having a good attitude about learning and like, you know, just like, I want to like make relationships and like work my way up. I know that's what we're striking about. That's like the ladder is broken and like people are not getting promoted on their way up. But that's got to be your attitude. I'm just here to learn, to be helpful, and to make relationships with people. And hopefully everyone's going to like me. That's kind of your job, is to make people like you.
Thanks.
And do you feel like, would you like to read a spec TV script as opposed to an original?
I love them. I mean, it's, well, we, you know, it's from, I read your Atlanta. The thing about spec episodes that's great is, okay, here's what's bad about them is that if I don't watch your show, then I'm not going to read it. So, I mean, if you were like, say, I did a spec, whatever, Yellow Jackets, I'm like, okay, well, I don't know that show. I mean, I heard it was good, but I can't judge it. Yeah. So then you kind of strike out. But that's why you got to write like a popular show or a show that like is sort of a classic. You could write you could write A Good Place still, even though the show's off the air. You could write What We Do in the Shadows. Everyone, if you're a comedy writer, everyone knows that show. And like, if you write a show that I know, then I'm going to be interested in writing and reading it. And a good one, it's fun because you don't have to create the characters. You just have to write in the voice of the show and have it be good. You have to write a good example of that, which is exactly what you're supposed to do as a staff writer. So I read them all the time. When I do my challenge, you know, or my birthday challenge where I read scripts, I mean, I'm not going to say it's like half specs, but I always say specs are welcome. And I might read 10 to 20% of them are specs. Cause when I see shows that I know and that I like, I'm like, I'd rather take my chances, you know, on a poker face than some script. I don't know who this is or what it's about. The chances of the original spec being that good are not that good. Whereas the poker face are probably pretty good.
I agree. It's funny because I have two specs. I wrote an Atlanta and an Insecure, and I still use those today.
Yeah.
Like I'll double up. Like if it's a gig, I'll be like, yeah, send the original and the spec.
Yeah.
And just double up, you know?
Yeah, I know there's showrunners out there who are like, oh, I don't read spec episodes. But I mean, so it's everyone's personal taste, but I think they're great. Yeah. I prefer them. I don't know why the industry changed the way what it expects out of new writers in the last 20 years. It just completely flipped the rules. It just doesn't really make sense.
Yeah.
I get that there's so many shows on the air that the odds of me reading, you know, knowing the show that you wrote a spec of, I think they're still pretty good. Cause if you look at the top shows, you know, there's a good chance if you're half hour, it's a pretty good chance. I mean, if you wrote a bear spec, that would be a weird spec to write because it's our drama, but still you'd be like, hey man, I would love to read a bear spec. Cause
me too.
That's going to be, I mean, it would be crazy to even try that. And that's why you'd want to read it. Right.
Yeah, I agree. Plus, it's just good practice. It's good practice. Mm-hmm. Like, because I think it did prepare me for when I got in my first room because I had to do research when I wrote that spec, right? So I had to watch episodes, get how they talk, how the episode. And so when I got on staffed on my show, I did the same thing. I already knew what to do. I'm going to watch all the episodes, take notes, and then I come prepared. And like you said, it's not my voice. It's the show's voice that you have to figure out.
Yeah. And it's like your instinct is like, well, in half hour, if you're like, oh, I have a great joke that would be this character is a situation where this character could say something really funny here, but it's not in that character's voice. Well, don't put it in the script then, because then I'm just going to be like, well, that's a good joke for someone else, but that's not this character, you know? So like now you're just making me have to rewrite you.
Yeah. That's like the person in improv class who, no matter what the scene is, like they're going to do the bit that they prepared, even if it's totally inappropriate. That always sucks. I want to circle back for one second to Weight of the World, the Chris Farley movie that never was.
Okay.
You mentioned that the movie. Sure. That's all I want to talk about.
I wrote it in 1997, but let's go on. Great.
Saeed and I weren't born yet then. So, you know, we just have to take your word for like what the 90s were like.
No, I was.
That's
I
a
was.
Joke. I That's a lie. Joke. No, That's I know. A I know. Joke.
I, was gonna say. I wrote it on my typewriter.
I had a pager, but go ahead.
Well, that part's true. I mean, not me, but I mean, this is not making fun of anyone, but my wife, she had a pager in film school, and it was like, because she was a producer, like she'd already produced things, and she needed to be reached. She had a pager.
Yeah, come on.
Listen, she was important. She was a busy, booked, busy and blessed. Okay. So in Weight of the World, you mentioned that the film opens with like set piece after set piece. And I'd love to know, you don't have to say like what the set pieces were in Weight of the World, but I'm always curious to know what a writer's process is for coming up with a set piece, because a set piece is almost outside of the story that you're trying to tell. And it's the thing that takes your story from essentially like an indie movie to like a big movie. Yeah.
So a couple things there. First of all, let's just, for people who are listening who are not familiar with the set piece. So a set piece is, in the olden days, a a sequence of a movie. It's not necessarily one scene, but can be one scene that generally required a big set, right? So it needed a giant set. Like in Animal House, it's the end where they have the float and it's like a big set. So the set piece was the big set. But now it means like the big scene that's like the trailer moment. So we kind of use it synonymous with like the trailer moment, like the best scene of the movie. In comedy, it's where the comedy really escalates and it gets joke upon joke. And then it's usually the funniest scene, you know, so like American Pie, it's like when he's, you know, what with the pie, it's like those kind of set pieces are really trailer moments. So in when you're writing a feature, especially comedy, but it's but also 100% the same in action or horror, anything where there's a genre where you're trying to elicit a very specific emotion. So if it's like you're trying to scare people, you're trying to make them laugh, you know, you're trying to like be thrilling, you know, maybe not in like a biopic, but like the genre movies where there's going to be like a specific emotion that you're trying to get and you're trying to maximize that emotion. We used to, and I still think it's a good way to outline a movie, not necessarily for a pilot, but for a movie that's going to have that length, 100 pages to 120 pages, you're going to outline it in terms of set pieces, in terms of the big moments that you're going to string together logically. And like when you said they kind of like can be out of the plot, hopefully they're not. Hopefully it is perfectly integrated to the plot. That's going to be the best set piece. If it's like, you know, they're on a road trip, they stop at a diner and something crazy happens and they get back in the car and go, but the diner didn't have any impact on the road trip, that's not a great set piece. It honestly won't be as funny if you're doing a comedy if it's not connected plot-wise. So if you look at Dumb and Dumber, you know, when they stop at the diner and they like, you know, put the rat poison in the hamburger and he's eating the hot peppers and the guy keels over and he's dead, it's a really funny, and you know, he's doing the mustard and the ketchup. That's a really big sequence and a really big set piece, but it's integrated so well with the plot because him killing that guy is part of the plot and like the fact that those two goons are chasing them, whatever. So integrated to the plot is good. So okay, how do you even create a set piece in the first place? And it's the hardest thing in the world. But if you have a big idea for your movie or a big character or both, so like a really distinctive character, you know, if it's like The Witcher or like it's like, you know, Ethan Hunt or just a character that's like Reacher, if it's a character that's like larger than life that has like a very distinctive point of view that can like is proactive. Very important that your character be proactive because otherwise it's hard to get them to do anything.
Right.
But so if it's big character or big concept or both, then the first thing I do when you're outlining a feature is like what I call the sort of exploitation of the concept. So the promise, I call the promise of the premise. Okay. So you've got a big premise. What is the promise of the premise? What are you hoping I'm going to do? It's the fan service, not like in terms of like, oh, we're going to do Easter eggs about franchise moments. But like when you watch Jim Carrey, you know, and you say, oh, there's a new Jim Carrey movie and he's going to be an astronaut, you know, but it's this goofy comedy. What are you hoping is going to happen?
You know, yeah, for sure.
You're hoping that he's going to be like floating in space, trying to like eat food and the food's floating by. And I'm just off the top of my head, obviously, because I just made this up, but he's like squirting. Because maybe I'm going with the ketchup and the mustard thing, but he's squirting like the dried food and it's like going like this and he's trying to get it and it's not going in his mouth and he's floating. So like that then becomes the anchor of that set piece. So is that enough? No, it's like, it's a moment. But like, okay, now we're liking like a zero-G Jim Carrey trying to eat food is like what the audience would like to see in that kind of movie. So how can we subvert that expectation in a way that's funny and surprising? And then the key to making the set piece really work is to keep going with it and to have the layers escalate. So it's escalating horror, escalating comedy. It's not like there's a joke. And then you're like, oh, good joke. And then you're done. It's like there's a joke, but then something else surprising happens that makes the joke go further and escalates. So like, it's hard to make set pieces up the top of your head, but if we're going to go with this astronaut thing and he's got the thing going and he's trying to get the thing in, he's going around and he's trying to like maneuver through the thing. But because he's so focused on getting the food, now he flips the switch and now the rocket's turning.
Yeah.
And a lot of this, in comedy, but again, action and horror as well, you have to put yourself in the mindset of a storyboard artist and think about the physicality of the scene. What is you're imagining things when you're writing about the location, the set, and but you have to physically put it in three dimensions in your mind. Say, okay, now he's like in this capsule and like the thing is floating by. And then his foot hits the button and now we're outside and you see the retro rocket turns on and it goes, shh. And so the rocket doesn't blast this way. That could be funny, but what if just one rocket and now it's turning? Mm-hmm. Now the rocket's turning and you're thinking like a storyboard artist. You're thinking physicality and you're making physical humor or physical horror or physical action. Like, you know, if Tom Cruise is on the airplane, well, what happens to the airplane? Is the airplane diving? Now he's... the gravity has changed. So now in the last Mission Impossible movie, which I just saw, the train goes over and now it's going this way. Now the gravity's different. So you're thinking about all these things. Okay, now the rocket's turning like this. And ooh, because I know a little teeny hint of physics, now it creates a little bit of gravity. So now because it's turning and it's going faster and faster, he's still trying to get the food, but now he realizes that he flipped the switch, so he's now trying to flip the switch, but now it's like one of those rides at the music park where he's getting pinned to the wall because it's spinning.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just making shit up. But the point is that you're taking what the audience wants the premise to deliver.
Mm-hmm.
Ask Jim Carrey's an astronaut. That's all we started with. And we're like, okay, well, he's in space, there's zero G, he's trying to eat food. And we created a premise that's kind of like delivering the fan what they want. But because of like the physicality and the escalation, your mind just starts creating scenarios and then it just keeps going and you're not going to make it be 15 pages, but you know, it could be five, it could be three, it could be 3 to 5 pages of like escalating comedy. And depending what the tone of your movie is, the more you keep pushing it, the sillier the movie becomes. But if it's Jim Carrey, you're okay with it. If it's a very grounded reality, then you kind of maybe have to like pull back and be like, you know, if it's like Beef or like the movie I just saw, I want to say like Road Trip or Girls Trip, the one where they go to China. It's a confusing title to me because there's not much of a road trip involved. Yeah. They just go to one place. It's not much of a trip, but very funny movie. And like, but if it's like got that kind of grounded tone, then it's like, you know, the car is spinning rapidly and like just it's escalating, and then boom, it stops.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just like, what the fuck just happened? And it's like, you bring it back to reality. Anyways, that's how you create set pieces.
I like it. I like it. No, in Mission Impossible, they had that where the train broke, right? And it was hanging and it was like one after one after one kept falling. They had to hop through. Like, right. That's what we want to see when we go see Mission Impossible.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It's not enough. Yeah.
Because now that the train is 90 degrees perpendicular to where it was, now they have to jump up to get to the next car before the train falls. But you can imagine that was probably something that was storyboarded.
Yeah.
And storyboarding in your mind, you don't have to actually do storyboards, is a huge benefit to writing set pieces because it's about physicality. Like, what can these actors do in this set that's going to really take advantage of the three dimensions and like the camera and like thinking like you're actually making it, like a director, like a cinematographer and like a storyboard artist, is what really enables you to escalate that drama, action, whatever. And like, that's a great scene because the action keeps escalating because of the physicality. So don't underestimate physicality when you're writing these scenes. And a lot of it's going to just be action lines. It's not like the dialogue is going to escalate. Mm-hmm. You can only get so funny with dialogue. Dialogue is like, oh, that was really funny. And like in a sitcom, it's like, oh, well, Frasier says this, and then Niles says this, and Frasier says, and it keeps, you know, there's like maybe four jokes in a row. And it's like, great. But the biggest scenes of comedy are like Niles in the bathroom and the shaving cream explodes and he comes out and he's covered in shaving cream. Physicality. It's like been that way for 100 years. It's physicality, which gets you bigger escalating comedy, drama, everything.
Look, I can tell by the way, you know, you're describing these things that you've got to be good at pitching. So please, any advice on pitching a TV show? Because one thing that I realize is being a writer, and you're just worried about being a good writer. And then you get into a situation where they say, okay, now you have to pitch your idea or pitch for an idea, which is something completely different. And a lot of us are introverts. So yeah. Do you have any advice on pitching either to get a project or pitching your own project?
I mean, I think the biggest mistake is thinking like a writer. That sounds crazy, right? But so you've written out your characters, you know your characters inside and out, you know where they were born, you know where they went to elementary school. It's not in the pilot, but you know it. Mm-hmm. And you know what's going to happen in episode two, you know what's going to happen in season two. That doesn't matter. What matters, you have to take that down. You have to like edit yourself. You have to give yourself permission to not tell them everything, because they don't need to know everything. So you can skip things that don't matter to them. They matter to you, but don't matter to them. So you have to really put on your producing hat and say, what matters to a person hearing this, not what matters to me? Because you're not saying like, hey, I need you to help me. Like, you're going to be a writer on my show and you need to know all. Believe me, when you start a writer's room, you could spend the whole first week saying like, here's all the stuff. This is where they went to elementary school. And you could tell the other writers that stuff because that's good stuff for them to know. Mm-hmm. But the execs don't need to know that. So you got to edit all that stuff out and think like a producer and like pitch it in terms of like how a marketing executive would pitch it. I'm not saying it's like a trailer, but it's not like a trailer either. So when I start a pitch, you know, when you're doing a TV pitch, the kind of template is always like the personal connection to the material. You always start with like, you know, this is a really personal story to me because I grew up in this exact situation and it's a story that has to be told, but it has to be told by me because it's so meaningful to me. And that's all true. And you should say that stuff. But if you pitch 100 shows, eventually you're going to run out of things that are like really deeply personal to you.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to be like, I told my personal story in this one. We sold it. It didn't get made. Now they own the rights to that. I can't do that one again. It's like, and I have this other personal thing, but like, you want to have a career that's like, you know, for decades, and you're going to run out and you're going to have a personal connection, but it's not going to be like, this is my life story. So what you do is kind of make it a personal connection, but also why should we care? Like, what is it about this show that's not just makes it interesting, but like, why would someone want to watch it? Why do you want to buy it? Why should we make it? Mm-hmm. It's like selling. You know, so like you got to sell the show to them. So like when you're selling the show, you're not talking about like, so my first character is so-and-so and they're 37 years old and they're the kind of person that's like, you know, the smartest person in the room, but sometimes they can annoy people. It's like, okay, yeah, I'm with you. That's all good information. But like, so
yeah,
it's like, start with like, a scene from the pilot. You know, what's your best scene? Pitch it. You know, pitch it. Comedy, I'm not going to say it's easier because I'm sure that you can do this in 1 hour as well, but pitch the cold open. Pitch the teaser. So like we open on, it doesn't have to be the first thing you pitch, but you know, like it can be. You know, you don't need to mix it up. You can say like, okay, I'm just going to, and you can like lead them through the roadmap. Say, I'm going to start you off with a scene from the pilot that we imagine for this show, and then I'll get into the rest. Don't worry, I'll get there. But like, imagine we open the pilot on this scene of these two people and Bloom, and you're into like the, hopefully when you've written this pilot, your cold open or your teaser is pretty cool, right? So you pitch it and you're like, and boom, now we're in our main titles and you can see what this show is. Now, you know, he's got the gun to his head. What's he going to do? He's got to choose between his wife or the, you know, whatever, the government, or I don't know. And it's like, what's he going to do? Boom, titles. And that's the, like Hijack. I'm watching Hijack. Yeah. You can great imagine show. The cold open of that or the teaser. I always say cold open because I'm comedy, but they say teaser for 1 hour.
Yeah.
You know, you can imagine. And like, you know, it's Idris Elba. He's on the plane and shit. The plane just got hijacked. And this show is going to be 24, but with a hijacking. We're going to do every 1 hour episode is going to be an hour of the hijacking. There's going to, I don't know if there's 8 episodes or 6, but it is like, say it's 8. There's an 8 hour hijacking. By the time they take off in Abu Dhabi and they land in London or whatever happens in London, no spoilers here. It takes 8 hours of plane time. The show is 8 hours long. Every hour is real time. 1 hour of that flight. That's the show. And no one cares who the pilot was.
Right. The age. The pilot's 37.
Like, even Idris Elba, it's like, okay, so he's like a master negotiator, I guess. I mean, like, I don't even really get that much into his character. Like, it's like they keep saying like he's good at negotiating, but like,
I haven't seen it yet. Yeah, no, I know.
But I'm not sure exactly what he's good at, but it doesn't really matter because you're pitching the premise and you say, and so you could go by personal connection material and then, you know, start pitching characters, or you could do it. Here's the opening of the show. And now, you know, the show is literally called Hijack. And like, here's why I want to do that show. And here's why I'm the writer for that show. You flip it. Now you're doing the personal connection. And the reason is, I mean, you don't have to be cheesy. Like, I was in a hijacking situation, or, you know, I hijacked a plane. You don't have to be that, but you can be like, my dad was a pilot and he, you know, he was never in a situation like this, but like every, you know, time when 9/11 happened, I was 5 years old. I don't know. Some bullshit, I mean, some real thing that you make up or whatever. That's why you're wanting to make a show about Hijack. Or it's tough because like you can make a show like Hijack just because it's cool. And you got to be like, but the reason why I'm, then you're like, the reason why I'm attracted to this is because everyone's who's ever been in a plane has crossed their mind, what if we're hijacked? And, you know, every time I fly, me and my wife, we say a silent prayer before we take off. And it's like, my dad wasn't a pilot. Forget the pilot. My dad was a pilot 9/11. You're just like, have you been on a plane before? What's my personal connection? It's like, I have a whole ritual we do every time. And I'm making stuff up. This is not me, but this is the person pitching. And every time I get on a plane, I think to myself, what could go wrong? You know, or whatever. And like, now my personal connection is your personal connection. So that's how you pitch the first two. And by the way, after you pitch that cold open and you pitch like everyone who's ever been on a plane has thought this. And so this show is about, and now you're doing your about section. This show is about, boom, it's 1 hour, everything, blah, blah, blah. Now let me take you through the characters. They've made up their mind already. Now it's yours to lose. If they're like, no, you can't win. You can't get them back because you're not going to like sell it after they're saying no. They're like, oh, I don't think we would make that show. And not everyone would. Maybe CBS is like, well, we wouldn't do that. Or we don't want to do that because that's too scary for hijacking, whatever. And maybe Apple's like, yeah, that's cool. We want to do that because Apple did do that. So you've either not sold it and there's no way back after the first minute, or you've probably sold it, but you can still screw it up. So now you have to just like play defense. And how do you play defense in your pitch? And honestly, it's like, if you think, oh, well, it starts off, my pitch starts off kind of like weak, but don't worry, it gets good. You're never going to sell anything that way. You got to start off with like the money and then not blow it. And how do you not blow it? You have to tell them who the characters are and what your episode ideas are for the future and maybe one sentence about season two. And if this is a huge hit, we could even do a season two. And here's how. The point is, the rest of that pitch is don't blow it. And the don't blow it is don't make it too long.
Yes. Don't blow it. How many minutes do you think it should, like, it should be?
For half hour, the rule of thumb is 15 to 20 minutes.
Okay.
I say, I get bored easily. If I'm boring myself, I'm boring you. 10 minutes.
Yep.
Oh.
I pitch a half hour show. 10 minutes. 11.
I agree.
But I don't go 15. I'm 15. I'm bored of myself. Yeah. I don't want to. And Keechi and I, we do it together. Like we split. I do one paragraph. She does a paragraph. It's like we just kind of figure it out. And one thing you can, that's cool if you have a writing partner, is we do these planned interruptions that seem spontaneous to make it seem fun. Mm-hmm. So I'll say like, and then she does this. And like Keith should be like, that's not what happens. The guy goes, oh yeah, that's right. You're right. And, but it's, that's planned. It's like, you know, you pitch a thing wrong and the person corrects you just to like make it fun. So we do stuff like that. But the point is that, so now you have to pitch like certain elements of the show because the person who's buying it isn't listening anymore, but the junior person is still taking notes and they're going to have to be like, here's what the, so you're like, so there's five main characters. There's, you know, our Idris Elba, there's the captain who's, I don't give you spoilers if you haven't seen the show, who's like this kind of guy who's in this kind of relationship. And the reason why that's important is blank. It's two sentences. I'm not going to give you like, you know, 90 seconds on a character. Like it just doesn't matter. It's like condense them. If it's comedy, the hard part is you got to say something funny about each character.
I know. Yeah.
If it's a drama, you just have to explain why they're connected to the plot in an interesting way. It's like the pilot, but he's got a secret. In drama, it's like a lot of secrets. It's like we sold a 1 hour legal drama before the strike. And a lot of that was like, So this partner, this law partner is blah, 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 this type of person, but their secret is that they're secretly, you know, a drug addict or something, mm-hmm. you know? So you're like, it's about secrets. That's for drama. Comedy is like, we sometimes just pitch dialogue. It's like, this is the kind of person that like has to correct people. If you're in a room, you know, she just can't help but say, you say irregardless, like, you know, irregardless is not a word. I mean, that's like kind of a lame joke, but you'd be like, you know, you pitch a piece of dialogue. Okay, I get it. Moving on. Next character. Yeah. They're this type of person. And this is she in this situation. And what you can do in those, if you're pitching like that, is you can do your next section combined with that section. Your next section is episode ideas. It's like, oh, and don't worry, we're going to be able to come up with hundreds of episodes. If you want 200 episodes, not a problem. We're going to come up with 200. If you're doing a limited drama, maybe you don't need to do that. Yeah. But in a comedy, you're like, this has got legs. We're going to be able to make more of them if you want more. And so like a bunch of ideas for episodes. There's an episode where like this could happen. There's an episode where this could happen. Mm-hmm. So a better way to do that is to combine it. It's hard to do it that way. But you say, okay, so character number three is so-and-so, and they're this type of person. And so like you might see them in an episode about Sean featured episode might have Sean doing this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And you pitch an episode idea about that character so that you know who the character is and you just pitch them an episode idea. The hard part about that, this is getting in the weeds a little bit.
No,
is
I love it.
Can't pitch episode ideas about that character that involve characters that you haven't pitched yet. So each character that you pitch has to be an episode about that character and the ones before them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
First character is just like an episode about just that character because they don't know who any of their characters are. So the second character can be about the second character and the first character. Mm-hmm. And the third character can be about three characters. But the point is that it's a lot easier to pitch the last character than the first one. Yeah. Anyways, that's just that if you're going to do it that way, which is more efficient, that's how you get the pitch down to 10 minutes. Is by the time you've gone through your characters, you've already pitched all the episodes.
Yeah.
And so then you say, so obviously you've seen like what a bunch of episodes could look like, you know, and do you have to pitch the pilot? Not necessarily. Depends on the type of show. If it's a premise-y pilot, then yeah, you probably have to pitch, but you probably already pitched it in the beginning. Mm-hmm. If it's like this pilot explains the show, then yeah, but like look at a show like Silo. It's not really premise-y. It's like, I mean, there's a premise, but it's not like the pilot sets things in motion. It's like these people live in a silo and they don't know why.
Yeah.
Okay. Every episode isn't really like the first one launches the show into existence. Like No Good Nick is a premise pilot. She shows up on their doorstep and that without that, there's no show. So a lot of comedies are like someone's living with someone that they weren't supposed to be living with and they show up. That's the premise. But you know, other shows that are not premise-y, you don't have to pitch the premise. But anyways, so you don't have to pitch the pilot at all, unless it's important. And that's it. And then you kind of like go back to the end it with like a marketing hook. You go back to square one and say like, so like, you know, we just feel like a show about a real-time hijacking. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you don't know what secrets, and there's all this intrigue with all the people on the plane. It's like, who doesn't want to see that? I don't know. Mm-hmm. Work on a better conclusion than that, but
we could definitely do a whole weekend masterclass on pitching from you, David. I'll be the first to sign up. Me and Saeed.
Yeah, you should.
One and two.
Should. No, I'm going to say now. Go ahead and make your masterclass, yeah, man.
Seriously.
Like that is definitely, because I do feel like, you know, this is something that's not really taught and you kind of get thrown into it.
Yeah.
And it's not like your managers are like, all right, so this is how you do it. It's like you just get thrown in the water and swim. So I definitely feel like,
yeah, no one tells you. That's the weird thing is that we got our first agent and it wasn't like she said, here's how you take a general meeting. Like no one told me anything.
Right.
Like you need to do like a mock general meeting. Like I had no idea what a general meeting was. I was like, what am I supposed to be doing in here?
Yeah. Like I literally, cause I had just been a lawyer. I wore a suit. Cause I was like, well, I'm doing a meeting. I'm wearing a suit. And they were like, what are you wearing? I was so embarrassed. I was like on the Fox lot and I'm like wearing a suit and they're like, you don't have to wear a suit, you know? And I was like, you don't? It took me years until I started just like, I'll go in sweatpants and a t-shirt now. It's because it's like, I don't fucking care. And like no one I'm meeting with cares whether I'm wearing sweatpants. In fact, I look more like a writer that way anyway. But the other thing they don't tell you about general meetings, and they don't tell you about anything, is like what you're there for. Like, what are you supposed to be accomplishing?
Yes. Yes. That is such a good question.
Like, even the premise of, like, why are we doing this? They don't tell you the answer to until it's too late.
Yeah. Okay. So, David, you are this.
Don't interrupt, but do you want me to tell you the answer?
Yeah, please.
What are you supposed to be doing there? I thought you were sort of nebulously putting it out there into the ethers.
Don't save it for the e-course. Come on, let's get
it. So what you think a general meeting is that you're supposed to meet someone and have a conversation and like make friends. Which is not untrue, but that's not really what you're there for. Mm. What you're there for is to tell them why they should hire you.
Mm.
Right? I mean, you don't know what for, but you're there to sell yourself. And so when they say, like, I'll just give you a quick example I've told people before, is they'll say, like, the meeting always starts with some variation on where are you from?
Mm-hmm.
Where do you live? How did you get to LA? Or, like, where are you from? That's generally how it starts, right?
Mm.
And, like, when I did my first meeting, I'm wearing my suit. And I'm like, oh, I'm from Connecticut. And they're like, okay, cool. So the answer to the question of where you're from, it's the same thing as pitching. When you go, oh, I have to tell them all my characters, you don't have to do anything. You just have to sell it.
Mm-hmm.
When they
mm-hmm.
ask you a question, a writer with a writer's mindset thinks you have to answer the question that was posed. If they say where you're from, you tell them where you're from.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what they want to know. They want mm-hmm. to start a conversation where you tell them why they should hire you, why you're a person that's good in a room and should be working on whatever they got going on. So now in 2023, it only took me 24 years, is they say, so where are you from? I literally go, funny story. So I grew up in Connecticut and I was a lawyer and I hated being a lawyer so much. And I just launched into one of my stories.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote mm-hmm. the stories down and I've done 100 times and I've got 10 stories that I have a document that's written out. Here's stories about me. The time I was a lawyer and I used to walk in circles. The massage uh-huh. story with my dad. The selling slackers. I mean, I've probably got 20 of them, but
mm-hmm.
10 stories that I probably told 100 times. And, you know, you ask me a question, I will launch into one of those stories. If mm-hmm. you say where you're from, I'm going to go with story number one, because that's mm-hmm. the one that most tells you, who am I as a writer? What kind of personality do I have? I'm revealing character by telling you the story. I'm trying to be funny. I'm trying to be self-deprecating. I'm not an asshole. Mm-hmm. I could be a good person that you might want to work with by telling you my story. And so what's your story? But the person's not going to say, hey, tell me your story. They're going to say, where are you from? And then they're going to say the other questions. What are you watching? And if you're like, oh, let me just check my list. Oh, so I'm watching Witcher and I'm watching What We Do in the Shadows. Okay. That's not how you answer the question. That's how a writer thinks. You know, you ask a question, mm-hmm. you get an answer. Oh, what are you watching? Let me tell you, a show that I love is Boom. And here's why I love it. It's mm-hmm. like The Bear, it's subverting things. And the thing, I just can't stop. I watched it 3 times in a row. And here's why I would mm-hmm. love to work on a show like The Bear. It's not even my genre, but man, here's what I love about it.
Mm-hmm.
And like, let me tell you a show that I want to love, but here's what's wrong with it. And like, no offense to the people working on it. No one wants to do something bad, but here's my notes on this. And here's how they could have done it. If they could have just gotten a little bit more into the backstory of this character, it could have been so much better. Just mm-hmm. insightful and like having a point of view without insulting anyone, because the person you're talking to could have worked on the thing. You're not saying anything bad,
mm-hmm.
but you're just being interesting.
Yeah.
That's a new general meeting. Sorry, go ahead.
No, that's masterclass number two, how to do a general meeting. I mean, and also it's like having this arsenal of stories to pull from is really the key. Write them down.
If you can't just think of them off the top of your head, write them down.
You should tell them to your friends. You should tell them to your friends, like, you know, over coffee and see if like their eyes start to glaze over or not,
Or rank them. Like, here's my 10 stories. Rank them. What's the best one?
Yeah, no, absolutely. No, I love that you're telling us this, because in general meetings, like, people will say, where are you from? And I'll go into a 20-minute like solo show that I always do. But I love what you're saying about like having variety in these stories that like that you can pull from. And also, it's such a great note about what you are watching, which we'll ask you that in like 1 second. but to, yeah, not just be like, okay, yes, in my genre, what I'm watching at this moment is blah, 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 as opposed to actually having a conversation. Maybe the show's not even on right now, but if you can speak about it passionately, it says so much more about you, right? And like what your interests are. We won't take up too much more of your time, David. This might sound like an outside writing question, but you have like this endless well of creativity and enthusiasm and ideas, and you clearly have something to draw from, right? And it has to come from outside of doing this every day, yeah. Right? So what do you do to, I call it cultivating my garden, but it's what do you do to inspire creativity and like keep yourself interesting, really?
Well, I mean, I think that the best writers are curious people. And I think that we're all curious, you know, and if you don't like just live life and like go, hey, well, what if, then like, you're probably going to have a really hard time writing, you know? So it's just like, it's part intellectual. It's like things happen, politics, world events, just walking down the street, you get a donut and, you know, and I'm like constantly asking myself questions. They're not always interesting where I'm like actually say it to other people, but I'm like, oh, I wonder, did they make the donuts in the back here? Did they get them shipped over? Like, I wonder, you know, I wonder what, like, I was at Randy. I could talk about donuts for 10 minutes if you want me to. Like, I was at Randy Donuts.
He's doing the general meeting masterclass that's happening right now.
And like, I've never had this conversation before. It's like the ability to just talk off the top of your head, if called upon, is like the skill you need because you're just curious about the world and like, I was like, man, they have these giant donuts at Randy's that are the Texas size one. I'm like, I wonder, does anyone get those? Cause like, isn't it just like, anyways, I have a whole, like, I just a lot of questions about things, you know? It's like a little bit like Seinfeld, like, you ever wonder, blah, blah, blah. Well, I wonder a lot of things, you know? And like, so being curious about the world, but also like, I'm not saying you gotta like travel the world and like, it doesn't hurt to travel the world and like get different points of view and get different perspectives. One area that I find is hard for me is like, I came from a very like privileged upper middle class background. And when I'm trying to write characters that are not like me, I have to really like dig deep and like do research. And like, so you really got to expand your horizons and like, because you can't just have every character be like, I'll give you an example. I wrote a novel, my one novel experience didn't go over well, but I wrote a novel about four guys. It's the last weekend before they graduate from high school. So it's a coming of age comedy, like a R-rated thing. And I wrote it about 15 years ago. And when you publish a novel, you get all these people that write comments that you don't want. And a lot of comments were like, this is super like white privilege, like these guys. And it's like, because they're spending, like they go into the city and they're like spending money on this and they're spending money on that. And it never even occurred to me that they're spending an awful lot of money because like, that's how I grew up. You know, we were like, we were, you know, having beach weekend, you know, maybe it wasn't my beach house. It was some guy's beach house, but like someone had a beach house. It wasn't, I wasn't rich. That guy was rich, you know, and like, we like didn't go to that. We drove into the city, go, oh, with your own car? Yeah, we had a car because, you know, I grew up in like an upper middle class, whatever. And like, we had cars and like the idea that like most people wouldn't have been able to have that like weekend experience because these kids are relatively rich didn't occur to me because to me, they were normal. They were average. Mm-hmm. And so like expanding beyond your bubble is really hard work, you know, whether your bubble is here or there or whatever, and being able to write for characters that are not in your bubble is hard. That's why it involves reading and like reading the news and like just like talking to people who aren't like you and like being a good listener. I mean, I'm sure you've heard this before, but like I like going to public places and like listening to people talk, you know, like I'm like a good eavesdropper, like in a not hopefully creepy way, but you know, like I love listening to teenagers talk because I write a lot of teen stuff. And I'm really into like language and like linguistics and like how words are used and like how kids use words differently than adults. I'm always going on and on telling like kids, oh, like my son, I say, you've got a California accent. He's like, what are you talking about? Like, listen to how I say this word. Listen to how you say the word. Like we, obviously he grew up, I've known him my whole life. It's a different accent because I grew up in Connecticut and he grew up here. And like, here's the difference. And like, here's how, You string these words together differently than a person. I can speak, I can write dialogue in my Kichi's parents are Russian immigrants, mm-hmm. and I can write really good broken English Russian dialogue because I'm good at listening on like what can't they do because it's not their native language. They can't form the past tense like we do. No, like Russian American immigrant can say they went to the store.
Mm-hmm.
Not, I mean, unless they're really, really fluent, which there never are, they'll say, I did go. If everything is did, the present tense, that's just how they formulate our, the English language. And so like being able to like be interested in those kind of things, it's just, you can talk about it. Like, I mean, there's things I'm not interested in, but like, and I have to always be careful, like to listen and not be the one talking all the time. It's just hard in this situation because you're interviewing me. So I'm doing most of the talking.
No, this is you. This is you.
But I'm like, in my head, I'm like, am I talking too much? Should I be listening more? Because that is a note that I give myself all the time. Like, I want to like, you know, be learning and not just like talking all the time. So anyways, being a good listener.
That makes a lot of sense. Also, I feel you on the research, like. Even when I worked on a Flatbush misdemeanor show, like I'm from California, it's totally different slang than Brooklyn. And yeah. So I used to look up YouTube and just be like Brooklyn talking, like, you know what I'm saying? And I would find like these videos of like people shooting vlogs in Brooklyn and I'd be like, oh, these are the words they're saying. So I definitely feel like research and knowing that you have to step out and just don't write characters that all the time sound like you and do some research, like you're saying, is very important to making your characters, you know, well-rounded.
You did the research, and that's not everyone does that.
Yeah.
So like, and to have, you know, like to say, like, you should be able to like cover up the names of your characters and be able to tell which one's saying which, because they all have a distinctive way of talking, which is true. It's hard to pull it off in practice, but like, true. If you can like have them actually speak in different dialects of their own language, it's really great stuff.
We got one more question that we usually leave everybody on, and you mentioned one television show, but you might have another one. But one thing we ask is like, what are three things you're really excited about? And one, I want a book. One, I want some music you're listening to. And three, a TV show or film. So you got a book you're reading you like?
Okay, so I'll do it out of order. So
good.
My bands, I like to think that I'm like really cool because I listen to bands that you wouldn't think I would listen to. I think if you look at me, you're like, oh, he probably like really into like, I don't know, Foreigner or something.
Foreigner.
So like, I'm not like your dad listening to that. I actually like am really into like dream pop and like female bands. Like I'm listening to, I like, you know, Beach House always.
Yeah.
The band that I'm like fascinated with, like at the moment, that's on my Spotify. Like my Spotify is like all just like new bands is Mama. Okay. So Mama is like these two young women. They're like 22 and they went to Calabasas High School.
Okay.
And they have this really cool band. And I like Drugstore Romeo is also a really big band for me right now. And so the thing is that I think I really love about them is that all the songs are good. You know, like they have like a depth in their catalog, but they're like, haven't really like made it yet. So they're like opening for like bands and they're not headliners and they're just like 22-year-old kids from Calabasas. But their songs are all like, I think they're going to be big. So I like them and I also feel cool liking them.
You are cool, David. You are cool.
Oh, thanks. My kids and Kichi, all three of them make fun of me because they think that all my music is like really like whiny. Because it does kind of sound whiny a lot of times, but like Beach House especially is very whiny. Okay, so book I'm reading. I read a lot of nonfiction because my brain, it's hard to reprogram it to fiction. Like Kichi reads books, like she reads a fiction book like once a week. She's like reads 50 books a year easily. I can't read fiction. I do, but it's hard because it's all present tense. And I'm like, then it hurts it's all past tense and I have a hard time writing a screenplay in present tense.
Right.
it's confusing. And also like, I'm like, oh boy, they just spend like three pages like describing like this person's hair. And I'm like, just get to the point, man. Like, when's the action? Like, I'm like, I like screenplays. I like movies where, like, you just get to, like, the next action scene. And, like, this is, like, so internal monologue. It's like, okay, I get it. You're thinking some deep thoughts. Then what? What happens? Okay, so instead, I read a lot of nonfiction books, and I'm reading one about the history of Santa Monica. And, man, that's an interesting book. It's like, also, where we live in Santa Monica, there's these steps everywhere. There's steps all over LA, especially in LA and in Santa Monica. There's steps that go from one street to a higher elevation street. And I learned that it was when the rail car went from Santa Monica to downtown. Most people work downtown. So the steps were so that the workers could, or so the moms could, like, take the carriages down the steps to go to the supermarket or get to the rail to get downtown. So they have these steps that are built all over. And so it's like the secret steps of Santa Monica that tells you, like, where they are that you don't know about. So it's like this, the city that I live in, the city of Santa Monica, is like a haunted house, hidden passageways everywhere.
Yeah.
When the people are walking out in our neighborhood, they're like, they have the book and they're like, where's the steps down? I'm like, oh, you got to do it on there. See that guy's garage? That's not a garage. So it's like kind of cool that there's all this like hidden stuff. So the hidden secrets of Santa Monica, that's the book I'm reading. What's the third thing?
A TV show or a movie you're really excited about right now.
Well, okay. Can I just, I'm going to say something that's like not interesting. I'm going to say Barbie, please. And here's why.
Really?
I just saw Barbie and it's like, but I have to comment. I can't not comment on it because it was so good. And here's why it was so good. The hardest thing that we do in comedy is to just be original, but also be funny and not like have the go-to jokes or like the expected. And what I think Barbie does so well, just in the writing, I think the storytelling is really masterful, but it's this confidence. Mm. When you're writing, and I always tell people, okay, well, you know, they might not read your whole screen. They might not read the whole pilot. Might read your whole screen. It might be 5 pages. It might be 10 pages. So how do you make those 5 pages good and still be the beginning of your story? And it's like, you can't teach people confident writing.
Mm.
But when you see it, you're like, okay, this writer is confident.
Mm.
And it's just the character description. It's not like going on forever, but it's not like, you know, cliched descriptions or like overly flowery thing. It's just, you can just tell. It's like they're describing the character in a way that's concise, but like they're in command and you're just along for the ride.
Mm.
And like, that's what that movie was from beginning to end, like opening scene to the credit sequence. Just the whole movie is just like, okay, she's just on another level.
Mm-hmm.
She's just like leading you on the journey and not like hoping you like it. It's like, we're going next. You can come along for the ride or not. But the train has left the station. And that confident writing really shows in that movie. And you just can't teach it. But man, like when you see something, like when a first page is just like in your face, insouciant, and like, I know what I'm doing and I don't care if I'm breaking the rules because I'm doing it right. I'm doing a good job. And it's just, it blows you away.
That's dope. Well, look, David, thank you. This has been an amazing interview. What is your, like, how can people, what is the Twitter? Can you go ahead and shout out the Twitter?
Yeah, my Twitter is David H. Steinberg. I'm branded. I'm David H. Steinberg on everything. You want my Instagram, you want my, I when we all thought Twitter was going under, I signed up for like 20 other things. They're all the same. David H. Steinberg. I've got a Patreon, David H. Steinberg.
Yes. So
everything. If you just look for David H. Steinberg, you're going to find me no matter where you're looking.
Amazing. David, we also just want to thank you for your generosity to writers and like for being such a champion and also like for showing us like how to do it. You know what I mean? Like, we can't wait to be in your position so that like, you know, we can be as generous with other writers as you have been with so many strangers on the internet.
Yeah. Like, I don't want to like keep talking for 20 more minutes, but like, I think I'm just going to say that it's really your duty. Like when you move up to like pull the people up below you, you know, like it didn't used to be that way. And people talk about how the world's, you know, everything's gone to hell and whatever, whatever. But I think you have to be delusionally optimistic to be in this business. And I'm optimistic about the world too. And like, there's a lot of bad stuff, but it's getting better all the time. It's better than it was before. And proof of that is the fact that 20 years ago, showrunners, you know, didn't behave the way they try to now, which is to help younger writers, to teach people and to pay it back, pay it forward, and to like really try to make things. And that's what this whole strike is about, is just, you know, like people have said this before, I'm not the first person to say it, but when you're at a certain point in your career, you're not striking for your own benefit. That's not, I don't make scale. So it's not like I'm hoping that the minimums get raised for me. It's for the next, it's for the people who aren't members yet. You're striking so that the people who get what we don't have an easier time.
I agree. And on that, that's a mic drop.
That's right. That's right.
So, hey, that's what we call a mic drop.
Perfect.
All right, y'all. Two writers talking shit.
See you next time.
Two Writers Talking Shit is an original podcast created by Melanie Mars and Saeed Crumpler. Our producer is Kayla Guest. Our audio engineer is T. Kelly.
Listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you damn well please. All we ask is that you subscribe, rate us 5 stars, and give us a glowing review.
If you're not going to give us 5 stars or any glowing reviews, then why even log on? Save your rants for an open mic.
If you have any questions for us, and I do mean any, you can email us at twowriterstalkingshit@gmail.com. That's the number 2, and then writerstalkingshit@gmail.com.
See you next episode.
Bye.